Thank you for listening to this podcast from KX93.5, Laguna's only FM. We invite you to listen to more music and talk on our grassroots nonprofit radio station in Laguna Beach, California, from anywhere in the world on KX93.5.com/listen or on our smartphone apps. But right now, here's that podcast from KX93.5.
KXRN LP Laguna Niguel, Laguna Beach. Member supported KX93.5. This disclaimer is a statement notifying the listening audience that any opinion expressed on the air is not reflective of KX93.5, its management, or its board of directors.
And good evening, Laguna Beach, and welcome to Moody with Dr. Sage. I'm your host, Kim Sage. I'm a clinical psychologist, and this show explores our moods, our minds, and our real lives every Monday evening at 8 p.m. on KX93.5. So tonight we have another amazing guest joining us. Her name is Dr. Alina Bright, and she is a clinical psychologist who specializes in working with children, teens, and young adults who are basically diagnosed with mild autism on the spectrum, also previously known as Asperger syndrome. So welcome, Dr. Bright. I'm happy to have you. We have such an exciting night of topics to explore. I think that this topic is discussed a lot, but not really necessarily in this type of way and in the way that you specialize. So that's going to be really helpful, I think.
Definitely agree. Thank you so much for having me. It is a very interesting topic. I work with an amazing group of children and teens and young adults and parents that are just part of the process that they're going through.
Great. Now, so you have been specializing in this way for how long?
About 8 years. So wow. For the past 8 years, that's all I have been seeing is about mild autism. So just a few sprinkles of the autism there. That's kind of what I call it. Just a few toppings, and they do definitely still struggle quite a bit. And that's why they come to me.
Okay, well, great. All right, so let's get into it. Make sure you're talking super close to your mic, too. You might want to lean in just a little bit. There you go. Okay, so her practice is called Bright Idea Psychology, and 80% of those you see in your practice are on the spectrum, or the mild spectrum, and the rest, as you said, are usually siblings or parents of these children. Why did you want to work with autism? Tell us about that.
She applies ABA with her clients. And for the first client, this is the first client I've ever saw, we went to his home. His mom greeted us, opened the door. As we walked in, right ahead of us in his room, you can actually see he was about 4 or 5 years old. He was actually playing piano for us.
Wow.
And he was playing Mozart.
Oh my gosh.
Of course, she tells me he's about 4 or 5. He's very young. Mm-hmm. And he's self-taught.
Wow.
I was just amazed. I got the chills immediately. How could that possibly happen? How could that be?
Mm-hmm.
And as we got a little closer and sat next to him for him to play Mozart for us and finish up because he knew we were there now, she mentioned slightly to me that he is visually impaired.
Hmm.
And I just could not believe such a little kiddo that didn't have any training for playing piano, but maybe had heard Mozart once or twice, was able to sit down on this little bench on a piano and play this beautiful song for us. Just stunning, and I was hooked.
I see. What is ABA for our listeners who don't know what that is?
Applied Behavioral Analysis. So this is where a lot of the time some of these skills that the children don't know are broken down into smaller pieces and taught gradually and reinforced gradually to learn more concepts. It really could be anything that has to do with physical things, social things, communication things. ABA therapists are trained and they go into homes for several hours a day, several days a week to work with children and families.
So why do they go into their homes?
I think a lot of the times it's easier to see some of the behaviors that the children struggle. They do show a lot more of the behaviors at home versus generally out. outside of the home. They're a little bit more well-behaved in public, but not necessarily. I'm thinking of younger ones, too. You might see it in public. Mm-hmm. However, the older ones have learned to kind of keep it at home and be on their best behavior outside of home.
Okay, so when we're talking about autism, let's just sort of, we're going to go into mild autism, but let's talk a bit about what is autism? What are the hallmarks of autism?
We do know it's a neurological disorder. It's something that you are born with. It's oftentimes hereditary, passed down from generations to generation. We do see it a lot more often directly in the father's side or the father's side of the family. I do see it in some of the mothers, of course, a little bit more rare and maybe a little harder to spot, I'll say that, for the ladies.
And why is that?
Well, they're more expected to socialize and learn to socialize and blend in. They're less accepted to act out in aggressive ways, and I think the
pressure is on them to learn to socialize and connect emotionally a little bit more than boys. That's just some of the cultural norms. And they do take on some of those skills, and they are harder to spot. They do know sometimes what to say and how to say, but you really have to listen carefully mm-hmm. to see some of the logic behind it. So that's when you catch it. It just makes sense. It's very linear kind of thinking, and you're wondering a little bit, where's the insight? Where's the intuition part of it, the feeling part of it? So it's very subtle.
Mm-hmm. So when are most children diagnosed with autism?
Goodness, I think we have gotten better. Typically, we can diagnose children as soon as 12 months. I know we've had some studies where we can catch it a lot sooner than that. 12 to 24, we can definitely catch it. Do we catch it that early, especially mild autism? Probably not. In my experience and my practice, I would say the average age is about 12 to 13 years old.
Wow, 12 to 13 years old.
Right.
So why? What is happening that we can be diagnosing this early, but we're often not, especially, I get it, we're going to go into why mild might be more difficult to diagnose, but children do see practitioners, I mean, even pediatricians, mm-hmm. much more frequently than we as adults, we see practitioners, and they have teachers and things like that. So what's happening that gap is occurring?
It's, I would say at this point, some do better than others in terms of blending in. And even when you get to know them, you would have to be very trained to catch some of these subtleties and not justify them or negotiate them to be something else, which sometimes we do have some typical understandings of, oh, he's just a little different, or he just thinks a little different, or this is something they'll grow out of, which is very common. Parents will see something unusual, and sometimes they'll compare it to the older or younger sibling and say, well, this is definitely different than the other child. But they will hope that this is something that they grow out of. They might think of something themselves that they went through as a child, some stages, and children typically have some strange, unusual stages. Again, not that they're on the autism spectrum, but
right.
Here's my job. We're in differentiating what is autism and what is not, and be able to tell you this is something that they'll grow out of or not.
Mm-hmm. So we're obviously talking about subtle behaviors, and if you have a family dynamic with some eccentricities, maybe we all kind of do things in a different way, right? Where do you think, where are the points, though, where we really could be working a little harder to be catching, especially the more subtle diagnoses, at an earlier stage?
Boy, I would have to say there's a lot of training, education, and experience that we all need. And there are a lot of resources for us professionals and educators, I would say, and parents in the community nowadays. The autism community has done a really good job. We're constantly growing in the past 5-10 years, amazing outsourcing services and support groups and reaching out in the community for help. So we do have quite a bit out there to be able to capture some of these kids. I would have to say, even in my own experience, you do kind of have to spend a lot of time with them and with a lot of them. And I say that because to me, as I mentioned, although I specialize in the mild autism, to me, they have their own spectrum. to me, they're all different. Mm-hmm. So it wouldn't just take knowing one to know what autism is or what mild autism is. You would have to know quite a few of them. You would have to know specifically what the autism diagnosis, which sometimes gets stereotype of this is what autism looks like. Well, no, we have a variety of symptoms within the spectrum. And mild autism doesn't necessarily have language impairment. So that would be something more obvious, where you don't have language impairment, less obvious. They're above average to above average intelligence. I mean, even some superior type of knowledge. So sometimes they do well scholastically, academically. They can get away with some things. They can be praised in this kind of way. Well, he's smart. Well, he has excellent language. So can't possibly be autism.
Right. And what about eye contact? I hear, well, they make great eye contact, so they don't have autism.
Yes.
Yeah, right.
I hear that every day.
Yes, I bet you do.
I just heard it today from someone in the school system. I'll just keep it like that. Well, they have empathy. Mm. They can't possibly be on the spectrum. But some kids do.
Right.
A small percentage of kids on the spectrum do have autism.
Right.
Do have empathy.
Right.
Skills.
Well, I think that's what you're saying is it is like a real rainbow of flavors even within the mild spectrum area. And so let's really go into, as you were starting to go into, what are the primary differences between autism and mild autism?
Right. So with the entire autism diagnosis, you would have to have some deficits in social communication and social interaction. Social emotional reciprocity, and that is back and forth talking and discussing and relating, switching topics, for example, is something that's a little hard with. When do we ask questions? In one-on-one conversation, the social rules might be the same. You say something, I say something. Then you say something and I say something, but put them in a group of two or three, those rules change. So when do I get to speak? Well, they spoke, you spoke, they spoke. Do I speak or do they get to speak again? What's going on over here?
Right.
So it gets a little muddy and confusing.
So they're not reading the room, as I say, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, and here's where they might have a difficulty actually learning that. I'll just throw it out there, but the theory of mind and their intuitive ability to catch on to social learning, you see. For them, they don't quite have the blueprint you and I have that we're born with to learn these social skills. So I say they have to learn it from scratch. We have to teach it from scratch. So this is where services become essential to help them with this recipe of teaching social skills. Or you might think, oh, they should know. Well, no, we have to back up a little bit and teach them some of these skills.
Okay.
The other one is the restrictive, repetitive patterns of behavior. So you'll see some of these things, very limited interests. So they'll have one or two interests, if two, and then they are very expansive in their interest of that one particular thing.
They know everything about it.
They know everything. They're little experts at a very young age. They beat me at every trivia game, every history thing. I learned so much about coding and programming, although programming is not sinking in.
Right.
I know a lot about U.S. history and geography, which I'm not really good at, but it's nice to learn.
Mm-hmm.
Computers, of course, I'm always willing to learn, but it's not my forte. But their brain are wired this way, so that's why we need them.
Right.
They tend to be a little rigid in their thinking and crave sameness. So simple routines where they know what to expect, where they know how to handle these situations. They have a heads up. So they do have a pattern of sameness and wanting routines to be the same. Changing those routines can be very stressful and anxiety provoking. So those two are the main ones, and it does include sensory integration, which is a huge part of their diagnosis. Either overly sensitive to certain things such as lights and sounds and
clothing.
Yeah. Yes, I do have that quite a bit.
Mm-hmm. Thank God for the new shirts without the tags, right? All the new clothing now without tags is probably like, it's amazing what a difference it can make.
And cotton is getting better. It's getting
softer.
A little bit softer and flexible. Mm-hmm. You don't see them in jeans very much. They tend to be a little tight and snug.
Right.
They're not comfortable.
Right.
Sweatpants.
Yes. Thank God for sweatpants too.
So So you do see them in sweatpants, right. flip-flops, mm-hmm. t-shirts, or sweatshirts, mm-hmm. and you see them in that outfit
all year.
Year-round.
Yes.
Year-round.
Yes.
It doesn't matter if it's cold or hot. That's their outfit.
Right.
Very comfortable. It's very functional. So mm-hmm. here's where the sensory becomes very important to help them feel comfortable.
Absolutely.
Or on the opposite end, you might see kids running on the playground and really taking a big fall. They get up and they're bleeding off their knees, but they're not crying. And mm-hmm. you're like, oh, I'm definitely going to expect this kid to definitely mm-hmm. fall apart. And they seem to be okay. They're not feeling the pain.
Okay. And why is that?
Well, again, sensory integration is their ability for their central nervous system, their brain, and their spinal cord to absorb messages and the way they sense the world.
Right. Okay. All right. So I guess the question is, can you tell us, let's go this way. Tell us a couple stories about some cases of children who have mild autism that maybe, you know, when you tell us a story, it'll make sense to us why maybe it was missed, but why with your skills, why you understood kind of what was going on.
Sure. Boy, I have quite a few. I don't even know which one to pick from. So we can talk about one in particular that I diagnosed about 12 years ago. 13, 14-year-old young lady. Struggles emotionally at school. Very bright, quite the artist. I mean, amazing art. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes, this is why I love to work with them, because they just surprise me. And they have such amazing talents that is beyond their age. Mm-hmm. But couldn't quite get along. She didn't like some of the things that were happening at school. She didn't agree with some of the teacher's logic, and I'll put that in parentheses, mm-hmm. or didn't see the meaning or the purpose of doing some things or repeating some things. Mm-hmm. So obviously they get misinterpreted of being defiant and just doesn't want to do it, doesn't want to do the work, uncooperative,
right.
non-compliant, mm-hmm. and here's where you have to kind of not presume that their thinking is the same as you would assume with maybe other kids, that their thinking and logic and justification for doing the things that they're doing is different. And when you listen to that, they may be right. So one of the things was, why do a math problem twice, three times, four times, when I got it right the first time?
That's a good question. I mean, I have to admit.
What's the point of that? It makes sense.
Right.
It's like, thank you for telling us that.
Yes, I agree.
So here where it gets missed.
So did you kind of have a sense? I mean, since it was obviously earlier in your career and what you're doing now, what was it that you first was sort of your mind was starting to check some boxes? What was happening for you in that? Was it in your gut? Did you just start to begin to put it all together quickly? How does that work for you?
I guess I could see a little bit how they think. I think that it reminds us a little bit about how we are, maybe deeper inside at the core, maybe some of those primal ways of thinking earlier on in life before all the social experiences and social filters or even cultural norms that we've kind of grown into every 5 years, every decade and so forth that we've learned from society that have kind of clouded a little bit of our thinking. And they're just a breath of fresh air. And they do remind us a little bit of being just genuine. And they're brutally honest. I wouldn't say brutally, they're just honest, but they may seem just brutally honest.
Right.
And they tell it like it is, like they see it. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of refreshing at times. I mean, we have to tweak that a little bit in our society nowadays, but definitely just honest, pure, genuine soul that you get coming across.
I can see there's an authenticity to it. It's very pure, right? And there's something kind of beautiful about that in
it
some
is.
Way, you're right? Because we do have to learn you shouldn't really say that. But if you don't really know that, then, you know, maybe it doesn't really matter so much sometimes.
Yes.
And sometimes we need to be able to be more honest, perhaps. So
Right. And it's interesting when I ask them a little bit about how to be honest in creative ways that can still conveys the message, but it's a little buttered because for some reason we need that.
Right.
I don't know why.
Yeah. Soften it a little bit. That's exactly right. Okay. And any other cases you can think of really quickly that you think, oh, this is another place where it really became apparent.
I just got one 13-year-old girl, has never been diagnosed. 4 or 5 years of angry, emotional outbursts at home. Mm-hmm. Only at home, so not at school.
4 to 5 years. Wow.
4 to 5 years. The family has reached
its limit, probably.
Their limit.
Right.
Yes. And they reached out to a therapist who said, this might be mild autism. Okay. And they were referred to me. And I took a little while to get to know the family and realized this was one of those cases where they thought this is just something that, again, was going to go away. Mm-hmm. And it never got better. If anything, it got worse. And they've tried just about everything they can to help her out. And it wasn't helping, and that's when they knew.
Okay. So how frequently do you see the emotional outburst piece, the sort of emotional dysregulation mm-hmm. component, especially in mild autism?
Quite often, even though the mild autism, I would have to say you see it a lot more when they're younger. Mm-hmm. Some are very particular and very good about just having them at home and not at school. Very small percentage of those will have them at school. Again, the younger ones, 6, 7, 8, 9, maybe stretching it for 10. At that point, I think they've known and they've learned by watching what not to do in right. public and how that's being viewed. And they save a lot of the stress from school, both social and academic, and they dump it at home.
Right. Well, that's where you're supposed to dump all your stuff, right? As parents, we know that's what happens. We got to be our safe place. Mm-hmm. So you've mentioned two cases with girls. I know that we are increasingly understanding that obviously autism occurs in girls as well mm-hmm. and diagnosing. Let's talk a little bit about the stats for autism.
Definitely. So now we have, according to the CDC and Autism Speaks, which are great websites to look at, including Autism Speaks, one in 59 children now have a diagnosis of autism spectrum disorder.
Okay.
By age of 8 in 2014, a 15% increase over 2012. So the question has been, I think, in the community, are we having more autism or are we better able to catch it?
Right.
So I've read a few articles about that. In my experience, I can tell you that we've gotten better at catching it. The services have expanded in the community. People have been more aware of autism, whether they're in the community or not, that are able to tell sometimes, you know, I think your child might have autism. Check mm-hmm. this out. Because I do have sometimes parents who will say, you know, somebody did tell me once. Mm-hmm. Oh, a teacher
I've
told me
I've heard that
once.
Too. Yes, yes.
And they've always kept it in the back of their
right,
minds.
Right. And years have gone by oftentimes.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
And we could have a whole other show on that, but I think trying to help parents come to terms with certain diagnoses like that, it's really hard. There's a lot of blocks, not just being diagnosed, but accepting it and getting treatment and getting matched with the right therapist. I mean, there really are a lot of obstacles, I think.
Yes, there are. And it's a process for the parents, too. Absolutely. And I get to observe it and witness it right. in the room. And I'm very cautious and careful about that. I want to make sure that they fully understand. To me, I'll say there's nothing wrong with them. They're just wired differently. I know we've used that term. They just think differently, but they're so amazing because of that.
Right.
We want that and we need that.
Right. We need diversity in our mm-hmm. world. Absolutely. Okay. So I don't want to go into this very much, but there's been still a lot of debate around what causes autism. Mm.
Yes.
So
well,
can you share with us your perspective? And
just a little
you know?
Bit, because yes, this would be another one. Just we do have a lot of family history. That's part of what continues to be passed down from generation to generation. We do have...
So you're saying it's very genetic.
Very, very much genetic. Genetic mutations in the brain development in utero that happened in utero. So as I mentioned, they are born with autism spectrum.
So this changes the concept of something causing autism?
Right.
But the research
yes.
is showing that they're coming out of the womb with these diagnoses, technically.
Definitely. Yes. We've grown away from, gosh, I hate to say this, but blaming moms for causing autism. No, that's wow. so many decades ago and so many years ago. But mm-hmm. we've come a long way. Thank goodness for that. I think they're looking for some environmental factors also. The one I particularly remember is older parents having children. Hmm. So that was very interesting to me. We are having older parents have children later on in life. Not quite sure all the details surrounding that. I've just read it, so I'd be interested in what else right. is surrounding that data.
Okay. So when you say family history, and I think you mentioned earlier, there is an association between, let's say, fathers and the autism diagnosis?
Yes.
Okay. No blaming here, guys. Let's just talk about it for just a minute, just because, you know, it's good to know. Talk about that a little bit, about why, and I guess not why, but why it matters and how you use that, because it can affect parents being able to even see it in their own children.
Yes, I believe there are quite a few workshops. Tony Atwood, one of the experts in the field, has mentioned that 60% of the time we see it directly in the father and or the father's side of the family as quickly as, let's say, an uncle or a grandfather. So it's important for me to bring them in. Fathers also
Absolutely.
To be able to get to know them, be able to get to know either if they are aware of autism or not. I do get a lot of parents kind of sitting there with me while we talk about what autism is in question. Do I have it?
Right.
So it is important for that fact, just to understand better family dynamics and just to explain. I think people are looking for answers. They want to know what's causing this, what they can do about it.
I think that's important. I've also noticed, and that's not my expertise, but I have had a decent amount of patients, many I've referred once I've sort of realized, okay, maybe this is something more mild and needs to be addressed. But, and also through friends, some of the people I've known have been highly intelligent, mm-hmm. Like the father's highly intelligent,
Very. Right?
And then I was wondering, and sometimes when I've seen if both parents are highly intelligent, this sounds crazy, but is there some sort of relationship between that?
I do ask what they do for work.
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to get at, I guess. I like the way you said that. And?
And, of course, it's very common that I see engineers
yes.
or engineers married. Both are engineers. Right. Chemists, mm-hmm. scientists, computer scientists. Again, and not necessarily both parents, but then you'll see maybe doctors also. If not right away, then you will see family members or a grandfather that was doing something interesting like that. So, of course, my little curious ears perk up and
yes.
I want to know a little bit more about that.
Right. Okay. That makes sense. What about siblings? So how often do we see it in siblings in the same biological immediate family?
I haven't actually seen quite a families that have both children diagnosed with autism. It's now that I'm thinking about it, it's usually the male. It's usually the male child. Sometimes, and it's very rare now that I'm thinking about it, it's either the firstborn or the lastborn. So I'm not quite sure exactly how that falls. For the diagnosis in terms of children. With sisters, again, I only see one diagnosis of autism in in the siblings, and I haven't really counted, but I can think of a lot of firstborns, okay. for example, that are having this diagnosis.
Okay. So while we're here, can you just talk about really what are the biggest differences between mild autism that we see, and I know this is a hard question because it's so varied, in males and females. So, you know, because I think that's one of the things that we were talking about is missing the diagnosis with girls. Why? What are the differences?
They're a little better at blending in socially, and boys are just...
So is that the big piece right
less,
there?
And less likely to act out aggressively.
Okay.
So... they're not behaving in ways that we can see it or catch it or give it serious attention where we need to bring it in. We might see boys oftentimes, again, you do see the ADHD diagnosis with boys. You do see the varying degrees of social willingness to engage. So these kiddos with hyperactivity, for example, are more willing to go out on the playground, play, but their social skills are struggling, but they're impulsive, so they're more likely to get in trouble.
Right.
We're more likely to spot them in that kind of a way. Mm-hmm. Kind of bring them in, bring them to the school counselor, bring them into the principal, send them out in the community. So definitely we're able to catch them a little bit more than girls. Girls are very subtle. And I have to say, I have a mom right now of a child that I see, a young 12-year-old. And we technically diagnosed her after a few months, but she was so good. I could hardly spot her. I think it took about 3 or 4 months when I looked at her and I said, I think you're on the spectrum.
Okay.
And she said, I've known.
Oh, she did. And what took so long? What was happening for you in the room there?
Well, she was very good at explaining things that were just good enough for most people.
Okay.
But her explanations were very logical and linear, like I mentioned before. Mm-hmm. Just enough for people to go, oh, that's right. Yeah, okay, makes sense.
Right.
But there's a pattern of there's something missing there that you would see in terms of the way she understood her child's behavior. Mm-hmm. And I think she always knew she was a little limited and struggled as a parent because of that. I definitely caught on to that. Again, something that normally she would be able to get away with and has gotten away with everybody else.
Right, right. Which is why I think that you said that the average diagnosis that you see in your practice is between 12 and 13 years old.
Correct.
Is that why? Because these kids have been able to sort of move through the world, you know, without being detected so much because they have these more mild behaviors and responses to things. That makes sense.
And they're very subtled or justified in different ways. And
technically, you could say, well, that
they're
does.
They're tucked in some other kind of label,
That makes sense. How do you differentiate between, let's say, a shy child, a child who has some social challenges, and a child who has mild autism?
So on the mild autism spectrum, I have a varying degree of children. I have the kids that come into first session chatting up a storm about a car or truck or something they're holding. And this is very serious conversation, very important. And Dr. Bright, this and that and that. And I've never met him before. Very chatty, overly chatty. And hence, this is where we kind of have to scoot it down a little bit and teach them, well, you just met me. You don't know if I like this or not.
Right, right.
And then we have more likely the really quiet, shy, very resistant to try new things, unwilling to come to my office. Parents are negotiating all kinds of treats just to make it to my office.
Right.
And oftentimes stay in with their parents just to feel comfortable with talking with me, to form that relationship, which takes quite a while.
Right.
But they're the kiddos that are quiet, and I always worry about the quiet ones more so than the louder ones, but they kind of get overlooked a little bit because they're not having trouble at school. Maybe they're doing well enough academically, and they're not misbehaving. So most of the times, it's kind of a break for everyone else because they are compliant, they're doing their work, they're very good students. Shocking to some teachers that find out that this is not what parents see at home, and that discrepancy is just unbelievable for some people that get these perfect little kids. And hence, that's the other thing you have to worry about. They're too perfect.
Right, right, exactly.
They're trying so hard to keep it together.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think that, you know, with shyness, it's one of those difficult things that you can learn to, I think, live alongside and become more skilled at dealing with. That's very different from that sort of playing back into a diagnosis around autism.
Right. Yes.
Okay. So when a family comes to see you, you're saying, what happens? Walk us through the process. Let's say I refer a patient to you. And something's coming up, and I think that some of the signs, how does that process work?
So they come to see me. They fill out a lot of paperwork. Mm-hmm. I'm very grateful for that. I ask a lot of questions. I meet with the parents and the child. I meet with the parents separately. I will then, if they're willing, if not, that's okay, to meet with me alone. Just getting to know them and forming a relationship with me. So even just forming a relationship with me, responding to me, you know, again, looking at me, the eye contact, not necessarily super important, but that's one of the features. I do see them being able to speak with me sometimes better if they're not looking at me Because sometimes listening at the same time as looking at my face can be a little overwhelming and overstimulating for some children. Mm-hmm. I do look for these signs. I do look for how they approach me, how they approach things in my room, what kinds of things they're curious about. I have tons of construction pieces and Legos to board games to stuffed animals to coloring pencils, just about everything that they would like besides video games.
That's often a favorite, right?
Right. And no, we're not allowed to play video games. We definitely unplug. Mm-hmm. Or all kinds of means of interacting that they would find interesting so that I can get to do something with them and get a sense for who they are.
Do you find that girls or boys that you need to have an activity while they're talking, more one or the other, or it just really varies?
I wouldn't say it varies among genders. It just varies more so on the autism profile, yeah.
That makes sense.
I would say, again, some of them are a little bit more chatty and engaging, some are not. They're very much into math, science, art, history, computer science. So there's a few things that I know that may attract them. I have a few trivia games. I have a few card games. So I do have a variety of things that they may be leaning towards. And that's also very interesting to me in terms of what they pick to be able to engage. And just that interaction back and forth becomes very much analytic in terms of I'm looking for these little things, little subtleties in terms of interacting with me. I would call it, where are those little glitches in the system where I might be joining with you, but then you're taking a left turn and I lost you. Right. Like, what happened?
Where did you just go? Exactly. And you said joining, which is really a therapy word, but that really is about how we're building rapport and engaging and sort of coming alongside someone to begin to get to know them. Right?
Yes, and feel comfortable with us. This is their room. This is their office.
Right.
This is their place to be who they are, to be comfortable. I encourage them to talk to me about everything they want to talk to me. Good things, bad things, anything throughout their day. Mm-hmm. Nothing in specific, because I'd like to be able to get to know them and I can pull from these other things to try to help them.
Right. So then how do you help them? What are you doing? So they've joined, you've gotten to know them, you're getting a little idea into where their challenges may be. Then what happens?
It depends a little bit how old they are. So with some of the younger children, I don't mind playing a variety of things. And I have taken therapy games and I have taken regular board games where I teach a lot of problem-solving skills, decision-making skills, how to interact with me as a player. What are some of the things that we must do in terms of following the rules to be fair, so to speak, and why that's important?
Do you get challenged on that?
Not so much. They do. Some of them, you'll see they're a bit of a rule follower. Mm-hmm. They do like to follow these instructions because they're simple. You see, it makes it okay.
There's a linear process.
We got to stick with it. Sometimes they call me on it, if anything. Make sure you stick with what you said, Dr. Bright.
Right.
So here's where I learn a lot about their abilities and things that we need to work on to add more on top of that. Some of the older kids and some that have been with me for a while can actually come in and tell me. They know I do teach them how to do therapy. So they know when they come to me, they have to tell me some things about their life, especially some of the things that we need to work on. Mm-hmm. So some stories. So even teaching them how to tell me stories about their life becomes very important. And what are kind of things that psychologists or therapists need to know about their life so I can help them with these things in this particular way. So they are able to sit down and tell me a lot of obstacles on the road with their friends, with how they understand people, how they get along with teachers and school staff, how they get along with parents, siblings, just everyone in the community, how they navigate that world and kind of put some of those pieces for them in the sequence so that they're able to navigate a little better.
So do you find that they're open to that? I mean, I'm thinking about like a middle school, you know, some kids are like, I have it figured out. You can't really offer me much. I kind of know what I'm doing, and they can be a little rigid that way. So how do you approach in those types of situations?
I don't get that particular defiance, I would say. They might just have an issue with the way I see things that's different than theirs, and they might not see anything wrong with their type of thinking or they're doing, because again, behind it, there's a different logic that makes sense. And again, they tell me and I'm all, it makes sense. I get it. But let's put that in the social context,
right,
and put some more pieces in there. See if you can navigate it a little better in terms of, again, reading the room, reading your friends, mm-hmm, being a little bit more mindful, active, listening, asking questions, just show interest and so forth. So this is where the social skills component comes in.
Right.
I do have some that have depression and anxiety, ADHD, OCD, which are the other typical diagnoses that come with the spectrum. So those require cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT, tools and skills for depression and anxiety to help them manage those skills, but also to understand where that's coming from. Oftentimes it is from their identified social impairment. So if you don't help them with that, you may not help them so much with that depression or anxiety.
That makes sense. I think the part that I find so difficult for all of our kids really is the social piece. And
yes,
so I think it's hard even if you're nowhere near the spectrum, trying to navigate, I'm thinking of like late elementary, middle school, right? And so now you have another deficit to try to manage, trying to understand, why did your friend say or do that? Especially if you're limited.
Yes.
I think that there's a lot of suffering in that area for kids all the way around, but I'm imagining because of that lack of social skills, that can be very, very isolating at times for kids.
It's very tough. Middle school is quite the thing. We just have to survive.
Just endure it. Yeah.
And we have to learn to survive. You see, somewhat make it through. We have to teach children how to survive and manage difficult situation, because they may be in those difficult situations in the future and may not have the option to walk out.
Mm-hmm.
And so how do we become a little sophisticated about managing that just enough to make it by?
Right. It's very challenging.
Mm-hmm.
So are you working with parents at the same time? What happens for parents when they're coming to see you?
I would have to say, and I tell parents all the time, for the first year, I'm not worried about them being perfect little interventionists on some of these autism symptoms. I tell them, I give you a year to get to know your child's thinking. Once you understand how your child thinks, then you'll know what to do.
I love that. That's awesome. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So patience, mm-hmm, take a whole year,
yes,
with me separately. Yes, you can read some things. Yes, you can educate yourself quite a bit. Start reaching out in the community to belong to some support groups and parent support groups. Join Autism Speaks. Join Talk About Curing Autism. It has a lot of resources in the community for parents. Let's learn together about your child, because I will too be in the same process. Each one of them, again, is different. So I will be learning about the way they think as you are. And together we'll figure out what works for them and how to connect with them. If we're wanting them to kind of come halfway, it's only fair that we kind of meet them halfway.
That's true.
So Tony Atwood talks about, we need to learn how to speak Asperger-ish.
Mm-hmm.
We do.
I agree. I totally agree. As you're saying that, I'm wondering, so if your child is on the mild spectrum,
yes,
what about resources and support? Because I'm wondering, you know, the parents who have more severe child or children or family members with autism, in terms of access to resources and support, what happens if you're in the mild category?
Again, so we used to have the diagnosis of Asperger syndrome, which indicated a group of children, again, still on the spectrum, that didn't have the language impairment, didn't have the intellectual impairment. They just had the social struggles. And many of them wanted to make friends. You see, we have some kids on the high-functioning mild autism spectrum that just do not want to make friends. They're fine without friends.
Right.
They prefer to be alone, entertaining themselves with the things that they want and love, and they're perfectly fine. Less likely to have depression and anxiety because of that. You see more kids with Asperger diagnosis wanting to make friends, but because they don't have the tools, now they're struggling to make friends, and it hurts. It hurts them,
yes,
very much.
Yeah.
So here is where we have some Asperger support group. Just putting in the Asperger syndrome in the Google search engines, you see a lot of Orange County resources. OCAspergers.org has a community. TACA has a community. There's a Facebook community for Asperger's. There are quite a few. So just look for that one, I would say, more in particular, because I don't, there is a lot of information about the autism, but you can get lost. Tony Atwood, the expert, as I mentioned before, wrote a complete guide to Asperger's syndrome. Wow. So here's where you have a lot of information just about the mild autism spectrum. Now, I warn you, you're reading this book, and let's say parts of this are going to be your child, parts are not. So you're not going to be fitting into everything he says. Again, they're all love of the place, for example. But that's one way to kind of learn mild autism and then reach out to these communities, specifically for mild autism or Asperger's, to get a little bit more support in that area.
And I'm assuming there are some great social skills groups that your child could attend.
Yes, peers. Yeah, so we do have a few in Orange County. If you put P-E-E-R-S, you might be able to have a few for their usually designated for the younger children, I'm not quite sure, 6 to 10 maybe. And then we have some teen groups. And some people will go out of their way and do some young adult groups because they sure need it too.
Absolutely.
We just don't have enough resources for adults quite yet.
So, yeah, so what? How do we fix that? What's lacking and where is a place that we can fill that gap?
That's a big one. I think we're, from what I have come across and see, I'm so particular about the research that I know with children and teens, that I would want to be more on top of that research. We don't have as much research for adults versus children. I think we're learning more research is coming out, more books are being written, more education is being offered for adults. I just don't quite see as many services, as many people that specialize in adults or willing to see adults. It's definitely something new that we need to expand on for sure.
It sounds like it. Okay, so as we're wrapping up a little bit, mm-hmm. What are the main things that you want our listeners to leave listening today to really understand, let's say, how to identify mild autism? Because I think the big issue that I really understand is that it looks so different in every child. Mm-hmm. There's so many parts of the ingredients, different pieces. So it can be, we can't just say, well, it looks like this. So what's the bottom line about what you want people to know about this specialty and passion that you have for working with mild autism?
For your listeners and parents, I would like to suggest that if you have a question, if you've read something and it kind of, or you're not quite sure, it doesn't hurt to ask someone, a professional, especially someone that has had some experience with autism. Autism spectrum in general, I'll take that at bare minimum. And definitely someone that has seen a few more mild autism kids, mm-hmm. Because they are a little different in that sense that they don't have the language and the intellectual impairment. So I don't want them to be missed just because they don't have that. And these are subtle ways that you can see their social communication and interaction glitches. So have someone check it out. I would say go see a specialist in the area, have some testing done, definitely somebody who has a lot of experience and has diagnosed multiple times mild autism or autism. I think that's essential. But put the two together, the testing psychologist and another therapist or psychologist that has a lot of training and experience and education mm-hmm. in this area to come up with that diagnosis. There may be some speech pathologists that can take a look at pragmatics, the functional use of language for us. There may be physical therapists or occupational therapists sometimes that can catch this. They have seen enough kids on the spectrum that they can say, yeah, I think they kind of look like many of the other kids I've had before. So sometimes this is some clues that maybe we can check out. Let us check it out. We can tell you yay or nay. Don't wait. Early intervention is so crucial for them. Right. The younger we can catch them, the more willing they are to do the therapy, especially the social skills groups. Right. As a teenager, I get a lot of, nope, you're not putting me in that group.
No, thank you. And I think that's really important. So first of all, early diagnosis really can make an incredibly big difference.
Huge change.
And why? What is happening? That, I mean, obviously they're more open, but what is the core of what we're doing from a therapeutic perspective that makes a difference?
Filling in a lot of these spots that they're missing. And because of that, they're able to be more successful socially and academically, especially at school, and transition better as a young adult, be able to live independently and seek employment gainful employment and stay within the employment to be able to financially sustain themselves. That's essential. So you do see some kids that have been taken out of school or have not received services, and they struggle so much more becoming independent in their lives.
So it's almost like they're more pliable. You can sort of see the deficits, so need to be where the little places are that need to be filled.
Yeah.
And just like any child, the earlier we get to things, the more ability we have to make things better.
Exactly. Okay, great. And you reap the rewards of that later.
Yeah, absolutely. And everyone does. The human being and the family and everyone else and in our society, yes. I believe, too.
Definitely. They have a lot to offer to our society. I cannot do some of the things that they can.
Yes, I believe it. I know. It's amazing. All right. So in our last few minutes, tell us how our listeners can find you, where you're located and all that good stuff.
I am located in Newport Beach, about a block away from John Wayne Airport at 1101 Duff Street. And that's Suite 165 in Newport Beach, 92660.
Right.
You can go ahead and simply just Google my name, Dr. Alina Bright or Bright Idea Psychology, and you'll see brightideapsychology.net.
Okay.
You'll find some information there. You can go ahead and contact me through the website by email or call me at 949-385-3524.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Dr. Bright, for joining me tonight.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me, Dr. Sage.
It was truly a pleasure. And I think it's such an important topic. I really do encourage everyone to talk more about spreading the word, whether it's through, you know, schools, pediatricians, psychologists. I think especially in this level we're talking about tonight, where it's not necessarily so obvious, but really can be life-changing.
Definitely.
Yes. All right. So you've been listening to Moody with Dr. Sage. Our show is live every Monday evening at 8 p.m. Or you can listen to the podcast or download at your convenience, hopefully tomorrow. And thank you so much. Hope you have a beautiful night. Please remember that everything we talked about tonight is meant to serve for informational purposes only, and that this is not meant to serve for therapeutic advice. But if you are in need of mental health treatment, please do not hesitate to seek a provider that can help you. Thank you so much. Have a wonderful evening. See you guys next week.